Let me read you these words from Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 10, verses 4 and 5. Be really good if you had the Bible in front of you, either on a device or hard copy, if you're a bit more old school. The day will come when we'll just be handing out smartphones to people who don't have them at this point. But we're still with hard copies. If you put your hand up, you can have a hard copy or you can get it up on your phone. Proverbs 10, 4 and 5. Today we are thinking, continuing a series about wisdom, and we're going to be thinking about wisdom and thinking about what it has to teach us about work and wealth. Work and wealth. So here are a few verses, two verses. Lazy hands make for poverty, but diligent hands bring wealth. He who gathers crops in summer is a prudent son, but he who sleeps during harvest is a disgraceful son. This is God's holy and powerful word. Just a couple of comments directly on this text before we do some more general thinking around these themes. First of all, laziness here is contrasted not with working 24/7, but with diligence. So we mustn't set up a false contrast between laziness and being a workaholic. Neither of those two things are good. Okay? Laziness, not working hard enough, or the other extreme of working and making work the center of your life and it's your idol, neither of those two things are good. Okay? The right path is diligence, and we'll explore that over the coming minutes. And secondly, could I have that back actually for a second? You'll notice that embedded in the second verse is the idea that work needs to be properly focused. And so the work here, the diligent work, takes place at a particular time. This is an agricultural society. We're in a very different form of society. Does anyone here make their living through straightforward agricultural working in the fields? Not one of us, right? So we've got a bit of work to do to recontextualize. But the point here is, if we did, there would be times of the year when we have to work particularly hard, and times of the year, by contrast, when it was not so necessary. And obviously, the key season is harvest, if you work in the fields. Now, we all do very different jobs. We live in a much more complex society. More on that in a moment. But the point I want to make is, it just underlines the previous point. Diligence is not about working every hour that God sends. It's about working smart. Okay. All right then. So let's just have some general comments about wisdom, the wisdom literature in the Bible, and the way in which it's tailored to the culture it was in and how we use it in our culture today and how you apply it to your life. So could I have the presentation up now, please. It's coming. So, could I have the next slide? There we go. Then and now. So, in the Bible, a major theme of the Bible's teaching is what we'd call wisdom. In fact, in the ancient world, the idea of becoming wise was a very significant part of what it meant to be a mature and good human being. And the emphasis that we see in the scriptures on this reflects the wider concern about being a wise person. Now, if I ask you a question, just reflect on this for a moment. Would you rather be intelligent or wise? If it was a choice between the two, what would you go for? And what do these words mean? I mean, intelligence or cleverness, that's the ability to process thoughts and ideas and concepts and work out connections really quickly. And that's a good gift if you're intelligent, right? But wisdom, I suggest to you, is more important than intelligence. Wisdom is the ability to make good judgments. to make good decisions. I'm sure you can think of someone who is intelligent but not wise. In some respects, their intelligence is just a curse to them, because the intelligence tells them what they should do, but unfortunately, without the wisdom, they can't actually do the very things that their intelligence is telling them to do. Now, Proverbs is perhaps, if you like, the baseline book in the Bible giving instruction about wisdom. And the way biblical wisdom works is, generally, it looks at the world and draws principles out of the world and out of the way the world is for what it means to live a wise life. And we'll see some examples of that as we go along. Now, Proverbs, if you've read it, and I strongly recommend you do, by the way, is full of just basic advice, really, but done in a sort of way that gets inside your mind and lodges there. And it's full of very basic principles like we've just seen. If you work hard, you probably do well in life. If you don't work hard, you won't, right? There's a basic, wise principle. Now, at some point, as we're looking at this wisdom literature, a thought's going to probably go through your head if you're intelligent and engaged, and that thought is going to be, but it doesn't always work out like that. And that's true, it doesn't. Proverbs is, if you like, GCSE wisdom. And then there's other books in the Bible, like Ecclesiastes in particular, but others, that reflect on the fact that wisdom doesn't always work out. That's, if you like, A-level or possibly even degree-level wisdom. But given where we are, we're going to start off with a GCSE, right? And then we'll see how this works its way out. But I want to suggest to you that our particular culture does not show evidence of being particularly wise. And being in this culture, we are constantly bombarded with messages that do not necessarily encourage us to be wise in the biblical sense of it. And much of the behavior we see modeled by significant figures within our culture is almost like a foolishness parade. Okay. Proverbs, in its ancient... Incidentally, these wisdom books... So the wisdom goes right through the Bible's teaching, but particularly Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, some of the Psalms, Song of Solomon, and in the New Testament, the Sermon on the Mount in particular, and James's letter in particular, they are under-preached in churches like ours. So if you do a bit of research, you'll find that these parts of the scriptures tend to get preached less than others in churches like ours. Now, I could spend the next half hour reflecting on the culture of evangelical churches and why this particular sort of teaching doesn't surface much. We'll spend our time more fruitfully than that, I think. But suffice to say, I think it's really important for us to look at these parts of the scripture because they tend to be under-preached and under-considered in churches like ours. All right. Who is Proverbs aimed at? Well, I'm sure some of this was maybe covered last week. I haven't had a chance to listen to Tim's sermon yet, but it was probably in its original context aimed at young men as they were coming to the age where they were about to become responsible adults, hopefully. Now, that was in its day. In our culture, these principles of wisdom are available to all of us. Secondly, and it's really important this, we must bear in mind as we approach these proverbs that there is a big gap between the agricultural context in which they were delivered and ours today. So, for example, what is work? Back in the day, it's quite clear. Work for the vast majority of the population meant getting into your fields and making sure there was a harvest in due course. In our day, what is work? Well, it's all sorts of things. And it might be paid, it might not. I think it's best to understand work. And incidentally, I think we are all called to work, no matter what age we are. It's part of being human that we have things that God has given us to do by which we are meant to be fruitful and be a blessing to those around us, and provide for ourselves, and provide for our families, and be able to be generous. And it may be that your work is directly connected to your wealth. It may not be. Maybe you have sources of income that would remain the same whether you stayed in bed all day, every day, or whether you went and did voluntary work every day. If that's the case, well, that's clearly a fortunate position to be in, but it doesn't mean that you shouldn't be working fruitfully. The only people who get to stop working entirely are those who are dead in the scriptures. And incidentally, even then, when we're with the Lord in the new creation, I think there'll be fruitful work for us to do. Some of you are groaning because the prospect of that doesn't seem particularly good because you work too hard and you're exhausted and you want a break. I think in heaven, in the new creation, we'll actually have ourselves organized so that we don't exhaust ourselves, but we do have fruitful work. Who would not want to have anything to do? Okay, Alex, see me afterwards. We all want to feel that we can contribute, right? So the relationship between work and wealth is quite complicated for us. And for some, it bears no relationship. But nonetheless, we are called to fruitful work and we are called to be generous and wise with our wealth. And then finally, what does laziness look like today? Well, in this passage, quite simply, it looks like it looks like staying in bed when you should be in your field. And that's contrasted with the diligent worker. I think in our culture, it could be that it refers to somebody who is not doing the work that God has called them to do and has no vision for work and stays in bed asleep all day or, you know, Netflix all day. But the other side of it could be that you're working in a distracted fashion. That is a big temptation for us. So you're physically sort of at work, but your mind is somewhere else, perhaps facilitated by your smartphone. And maybe you're doing that right now. I'm tempted to do it when I'm listening to a sermon, because nobody can tell whether you're looking at the scripture or you're looking at whatever you're looking at, right? Laziness, I think, in our culture is not just staying in bed when you should be working. It can also be this unfocused life, where actually we're kind of constantly distracted. Wherever we are, we're not really there. All right, there's a few thoughts for you on the gap between the ancient culture that Proverbs addresses and our culture today. There's much more we could talk about, but as I said, this is GCSE. All right, so I'm going to give you five basic principles from Proverbs about work and wealth for you to reflect on. And hopefully this will goad you into actually reading these Proverbs for yourself, because I skimmed through the whole book of Proverbs in preparing for this sermon, and I picked up 30 to 40 references to work. Didn't even do the same for wealth, because there'll be even more, I think, for wealth. So there's a lot in there about work. And although society changes, human nature does not change. And these principles are aimed at human nature and trying to develop a wise nature. But here are five principles to be going on with. And the first one is this: God is the boss. Next slide, please. God is the boss. Now, you may have a boss in your workplace. Many of you will have, I'm sure. Maybe you are the boss in your workplace. I wonder if you like that role or not. My nephew, when he was just starting out in the workplace, I said to him, "What's your ambition?" And he said, "To be in charge." And I said, "Well, what do you mean? What sort of work do you want to be in charge of?" He said, "I don't mind as long as I'm in charge." I sort of said to him, "Yeah, be careful what you wish for. Sometimes being in charge is no fun at all." But anyway, God is the boss. Whoever might be your boss, whoever might be directing your work, it may be that you're retired and your wife is your boss, or your husband is your boss, you feel. They're the one that are setting the pace. Who is giving you guidance and instruction? What human person do you have to recognize and and do your work with some instruction from them. Well, whether they treat you well or not, underneath their authority lies the authority of God. God is the boss. Now, thinking back to what Tim was preaching on, the foundation of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And this runs right through the scriptures in all sorts of ways, that idea that God is watching and God is in charge. Runs through ethical conduct, sexual conduct, morality. God sees, God knows, and you're accountable to him. And that is fundamentally a countercultural idea. In our society, we are told you're in charge of you. You get to choose what you do, and nobody has the right to interfere in that radical individualism. Can I tell you, in case that seems so obvious to you, that it goes without saying, I want to challenge you this. That is a cultural thing. If you were brought up in other parts of the world, you would not think that. And that belief has done a lot of damage to a lot of people. Because ultimately, it's not true. We are accountable, and our actions and our beliefs and our behaviours have implications for others, and ultimately God will hold us to account for them. And God will hold you to account for your work. Now, this is both encouraging and a big challenge. If you've got a difficult boss, this is encouraging because you can bear in mind when you're finding things hard that one day they'll give an account to God for the way that they've led. And ultimately, whether they like your work or not doesn't, in the final analysis, matter. It will have implications for you, of course. But ultimately, the only person you're really working for and the only person whose approval really counts is God. And he sees it all and he's entirely fair. So it's a real encouragement from that point of view. It's also a real challenge because if you're tempted to only work in such a way as the boss is pleased, then this comes as a challenge. In the New Testament, Paul says to those who are in a position of slavery that they must not work merely to please their human masters, but must work for God, knowing that their masters are also accountable to God. So in the midst of that unjust situation, Paul can say, he empowers the person who is experiencing injustice by saying, actually, the only person who really matters is God. There's a limit to what this human master can do to you. And he reminds the masters, you'll be accountable to God for how you treat those that you are in charge of. God is the boss. He's the boss of your work. He calls you to work. If you work too much, he'll hold you to account for that. If you work too little, he'll hold you to account for that. He wants you to work as part of your life. He doesn't want it to be all of your life. He wants you to create a proper balance. When you are working, he'd like you to work in a focused way and give honest, good labor to the thing he's called you to. And when you're not working, he wants you to switch off and give your focus to the other parts of your life. Now, who here reckons they've mastered all of that? This is challenging. But the wise person is able to do this. They do the work that God's called them to, that is fruitful and a blessing to others, and they do it in a way which honours God. And then we come to our wealth, which may or may not be directly connected to our work. All the money we own, all the money we generate, all the possessions that we have, the Bible teaches, it's not just that God is the boss of how we deal with them, they're actually God's, and we hold them in trust. This is another profoundly countercultural idea. If you see the presupposition of much thinking in our culture, it's that what you've got is yours, you earned it, it belongs to you, what you do with it is your business and nobody else's. This is not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that every penny you've got, every possession you've got, actually this belongs to God. And he's given it to you in trust, and he invites you to use it in such a way that you are operating according to his principles and with the grain of the universe as he has created it. The implications to this simple principle are vast and cut right across the culture in which we live. I invite you to reflect on it. God is the boss, and the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and without it, there is no godly wisdom. Second principle, moving a little more quickly now, and that is, if you're lazy, you need to learn from the ant. Okay, now this is classic wisdom. I said to you, wisdom teaching in the Bible, it often reflects something from culture or from nature, and the wise person looks upon the world that God's created and learns lessons from it. And so one of my favorite passages in the Bible, Proverbs 6, I really like this. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a thief, and scarcity like an armed man. The ant is a natural example of wisdom when it comes to work, according to the writer. The ant doesn't need to be told to work, it just gets on with its work. It has a prodigious work ethic, it is very industrious, and it's very cooperative. And it's as though the writer looks at the ant and it says, God has given this ant a particular form of wisdom, and we're called to learn from it. It's an example to us. Now, I like this because I've got this theory. This is just me talking now, right? You don't have to believe this, but I think I'm right. And it's this. This is my theory, that animals all embody some kind of thing that we either learn to avoid or we learn to emulate. I'll let you just, you can have that for nothing. You can just reflect on that for a moment or two if you get bored in the rest of the sermon. But this is very typical of the wisdom teaching, that something is observed about the way God has created the world and we learn a lesson from it. So what do we learn from the ant? We learn industriousness and we learn focus. If you gave an ant a smartphone, do you think it would get distracted and, you know, suddenly ants would all stop their work and they'd be on TikTok or whatever, wasting their lives? I don't think they would they? Now, obviously, it's ludicrous, but if you tried to distract an ant, the ant just wouldn't get it, would it? Because it's got a purpose and it's getting on with it. I don't think an ant would be easily distracted. We humans are easily distracted. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. All right. And secondly, ants are diligent. And part of being wise is being a person of diligence, that ability to just focus and carry out a good job. Proverbs 22:29, for example, do you see someone skilled in their work? They will serve before kings. They will not serve before officials of low rank. Now, I ask you, the work that you do, be it paid work or voluntary work or whatever it is, working in the home, do you see it as something at which you are seeking to excel? Because you're doing it for God and you want to bring your best to him. Paul says, whatever you do, do it to the best of your ability, I'm paraphrasing, because you're doing it for God. Now, perhaps like me, you're tempted to think, well, I've been doing this quite a long time now. I know what I'm doing. You know, I'm a pastor. I've been a pastor for nearly 25 years. I know what I'm doing now. So now I can just coast on through, in securing the knowledge that I'm experienced. No. Whatever position you're at now, the aspiration should be to be growing in your skill and your diligence. so that you can do your work in a way which honours God more and more and more. Mike Vann, the operations manager here, he is no spring chicken, okay? I won't say his exact age, but he's, you know, he's certainly closer to retirement than the start of his working life. He said to me, my goal is every single day to learn something new about how to do this job. That is very good indeed. Don't rest on your laurels. Do your work diligently and grow in your understanding. Furthermore, being wise about your work, or rather not being a sluggard, not being lazy, is contrasted with those who, Bible's words, chase fantasies. Let me read you Proverbs 12:11. Those who work their land will have abundant food, but those who chase fantasies have no sense. Our culture, it encourages people to aspiration, and that's a very good thing, but the danger is sometimes we don't teach a sort of balancing common sense perspective. And so we generate young people who have completely unrealistic expectations of life if we're not careful. Chasing fantasies is associated in the wisdom teaching with laziness. It doesn't lead towards actually just doing work in the field, so to speak, practical endeavor, constantly daydreaming about unrealistic possibilities. Brothers and sisters, of course it's good to have aspiration, but the aspiration should actually make you a good practical worker, not mean you're constantly living in a mindset of thinking about what you might do tomorrow rather than what you should be doing now. All right. Third principle. So, God is the boss. The ant is our example. Third principle, contentment. Next slide, please. Contentment is a theme that runs right through the Bible. And the wise person is a person who has learnt contentment. Contentment is actually a very beautiful thing, and again, it's something our culture actively discourages. If you're watching, incidentally, when we bought Amazon Prime, I thought the whole point was you didn't get adverts. Now you get adverts on it all the time, don't you? I don't know what's going on, but, you know, it gets everywhere, doesn't it? Marketing, it seems to me. There is a right place for marketing. Please don't come and shoot me if you're involved in marketing. When you're selling the actual benefits of a product and how it might enhance someone's life and just making people aware of those, that's good and healthy. But lots of marketing is deliberately designed to make you feel discontent with what you've got and provoke an entirely confected, artificial desire to have something you don't need. That's bad marketing. Proverbs 15:16, better a little with the fear of the Lord than great wealth with turmoil. So this is an equation. It is saying if you put turmoil on one side of the scales and wealth on the other, then it definitely will come down the side of turmoil. Turmoil will outweigh wealth. So don't pay the price of turmoil just to be wealthy. It's not worth it. That is a bad, bad deal. Now, of course it's possible to have both poverty and turmoil, the worst of all possible worlds, and I believe it's possible to be wealthy and content. But the point being made here in making this to some extent false dichotomy is to say, if it's a choice, poverty is more desirable than turmoil. Our culture would say, I think, exactly the opposite. Paul says, contentment with godliness is great gain. And I'm pretty sure he was trying to make a joke, and I think Paul's sense of humour is not very strong. But contentment is great gain. We associate contentment with not striving to gain things. So, you know, you can see there's a kind of attempt at humour in there. You want the greatest gain? Learn to be content. Because if you predicate your contentment on having more and more and more, you'll never have enough. Paul says, I've learnt the secret of contentment, whether I have enough or I don't have enough. I've learnt an underlying sense of contentment. Elsewhere, at the end of Proverbs, the writer says, I've prayed that the Lord will neither give me too much, in which there's a temptation I might become arrogant, or too little, in which case there might be a temptation for me to become deceitful in order to provide for myself. I've asked that he'd give me just enough. Profoundly countercultural, but this is wisdom. It is not wise to push yourself further and further and further in the search of wealth. That's not wise, that's foolish. All right. Fourth principle, just got two more, then we're done. Fourth principle, integrity and justice. This is a huge theme throughout Proverbs. And actually, Linda's going to be focusing to some extent on this evening, so I'm not going to go into great detail. But let me give you a couple of verses just to bring your mind into focus on these. So Proverbs 11:1, the Lord detests dishonest scales, but accurate weights find favor with him. What does this mean? Well, in the culture of the day, you would often be selling your produce. And in selling your produce, you'd often use scales. So you might sell a kilogram of stuff you've grown in your fields. Obviously, they didn't have kilograms in those days, but you know what I mean. And rather than having a weight that weighs a kilogram, you might make it so it only weighs 900 grams. So when somebody comes to buy a kilogram of wheat off you, they actually only get 900 grams. Yeah? That makes sense, doesn't it? Hopefully it makes sense. And here we see a principle of wisdom. Firstly, you might get away with it, but God saw it, and God hates it. You might get away with injustice. You might get away with stealing, but don't be fooled. God knows. He sees, and he hates it. You exploit people at your own risk. You might think it's very clever. You've outwitted people and done very well for yourself. Thank you very much. And you'll go on thinking it's clever until you stand before God, and then it will look like rank foolishness because there'll be an accounting. Secondly, integrity. And as I say, I don't want to speak too much about this because this really is the theme that we've given Linda this evening, but except to say this. If you're a person of integrity, it says in wisdom teaching, you're safe. You don't have to spend your whole life worried about getting exposed. You think of, say, Bill Clinton and what he was up to in the White House. And then when he was living in fear that his private life would be exposed. Is that a person walking with security or insecurity? Is the President of the United States the most powerful man on earth? And he must have been riddled with fear that his private life would be exposed. And when it was, what did he do next? He doubled down. He started lying. If you walk with integrity, you're at peace. If you don't walk with integrity, you better have a very good memory. Because you've got to be on it all the time. And one slip and the truth comes out. And it all unravels. Lying is really generally a very, very bad idea. If you develop a tendency to lie, let me tell you something. You will get exposed. And it is the most shameful thing when people who you were trying to create a good impression on realize that not only are you a person who's done something wrong, but you're a person who then lies about it. Shameful. And the truth is, if you tell lies, most of the time people know. They may not challenge you, but most of the time they know. And in their minds, they think, you're a liar. Integrity, having the inner strength to be truthful and trustworthy, acting justly and honorably, and being consistent in words and actions. Finally here, justice. Proverbs again and again speaks into the the need that if you are successful in the workplace, you must not exploit your workers. Not only should you not exploit your customers, you must not exploit your workers. And we'll reflect on that briefly at the end. Your job, if you're in leadership, is not just to serve your shareholders, but to serve all your stakeholders. And if your company is profitable, and if you have some responsibility for how those rewards are shared, you must think about all the stakeholders and how you can share the success of your work with all of them. God is looking for how you treat those that you're responsible for. All right, and finally, fifth principle is generosity. Let me read you a couple of verses from Proverbs 21. The craving of a sluggard will be the death of him, because his hands refuse to work. All day long he craves for more, but the righteous give without sparing. The sluggard, the lazy, unfocused one, is defined by their cravings and trying to meet them. Whereas the righteous, wise worker is defined by their generosity. Every penny you have, as I've said, is God's. You are only a steward. And this theme of generosity, let me give you another example. Proverbs 22, verse 9, the generous will themselves be blessed, for they share their food with the poor. If you want to be wise, part of biblical wisdom is to be generous, open-handed, sharing what you have, using the resources that God has given you in a way which brings pleasure to him and honors him. And this is a major theme, actually, of the whole scriptures. I mean, I don't know where to begin or start with it. Who should benefit from your work and your wealth? Well, obviously, you should provide for yourself. And obviously, you should provide for your family and bless them. And you should also provide and bless your church family. And in particular, church leaders. Just declaring an interest here, but the Bible clearly teaches this, that you have a responsibility to refresh and encourage your church leaders with your wealth. And I'm glad to say here, you do that extremely well. Our church leaders are well provided for, those who work full-time for the church. But also the poor must benefit, both the physically poor and the spiritually poor. What a privilege to do your work and the outcome be blessing, not just for you and your family, but for a whole raft of other people, your employees, staff, colleagues, and loads of other people who may not even know your name. What a wonderful prospect to be standing before the Lord and say, Lord, I wasn't perfect, and for that I have Jesus, but you gave me this ability to generate income, and I used it, yes, to provide for my own needs so I wasn't a burden to anyone else, and yes, for my family so that they could enjoy blessings from you, but ultimately for all of these people. Some people around the world I never even met. That's a reason to get up in the morning and carry out your work. John Wesley said these immortal words, I think. When it came to giving, he said this, earn all you can. So he was a capitalist in that sense, at least. Max out your income. Nothing wrong with that. Very good thing to do. Max it out. Secondly, save all you can. Don't spend your money frivolously. Of course, meet your own needs and meet the needs of your family and provide. Earn all you can. Save all you can. Don't spend unnecessarily. Why? So that you can give all you can. Because every penny you give is, as Jesus said, an investment in the kingdom of heaven. It's a bank that God himself underwrites. There is no prospect of a run on that bank. Your investment is safe there forever. So, wisdom for work and wealth. We are called to focused, diligent, godly work. We are called to give ourselves for a proportion of our lives to the work that God has called us to do it as well as we can, whether it's so-called menial work or so-called high-powered work is irrelevant. We give ourselves to it, we do it as diligently as we can and as skillfully as we can and as focused as we can, and we do it for part of our lives. And when we're not at work, we're not at work, and when we are at work, we are at work. And this is a challenge in our culture, but it's what we're called to. Secondly, the wealth that we then generate, we are called to use to refresh, to provide for our own needs and to refresh our family, our employees, if we have them, the church and its servants, and particularly the poor. And the more you can do that, what a privilege. And so finally, I say these words of blessing for me and for you. May our work and our wealth please the Lord. Amen? Amen. And may our work and our wealth refresh his people. Amen. God bless you.